Hi, welcome to the I Heart Africa Project podcast. This is episode number 6. Hi, my name is Nikki. I run the I Heart Africa Project. I love Africa. It is a very special place to me. And so I'm putting together this project to showcase Africa in a very real capacity, providing insights into Africa from the perspectives of those who love it most. And on today's episode, I'm speaking to Ivan Carter. Ivan Carter was born and raised in Zimbabwe. And the importance of conservation and wildlife was instilled in him from a very young age, as he was able to enjoy the wild places on his doorstep. The youngest person to ever receive his professional guiding license in Zimbabwe, Ivan has now been guiding safaris all over Africa for the past 30 years, and was rated as one of Africa's top 10 guides by Condé Nast. He is a renowned wildlife expert, conservationist, TV show host, wildlife photographer, among many other hats he wears, founder of the Ivan Carter Wildlife Conservation Alliance, host of Carter's War, The Untold Story of Ivan's Quest to Save Africa, the world's most wild continent. Ivan is a hunter who is now a full-time conservationist, and he spends his time exploring new approaches and finding sustainable solutions to help bring about healthy and balanced ecosystems. Ivan once said, "Africa is not a place of darkness, and while the internet and news revel in tales of doom and despair, I see many rays of light and hope, and it is upon those that I am betting." It is an absolute honour to connect with Ivan today. He is truly a man of Africa, and is elbows deep, right in there, in the thick of it, doing the hard work in the field for conserving Africa's wild places and all those that live within it, the entire and vast array of ecosystems. And on that note, hi Ivan, welcome, how are you?
Hey, how are you doing, Nikki? So good to talk to you.
Hey Ivan, for those who are listening that aren't familiar with you, could you please introduce yourself, tell us your name and tell us where you're from?
So my name is Ivan Carter. I actually currently live in South Africa. I was brought up in Zimbabwe and I've spent the last 35 years in some way, shape or form involved with wildlife and wild places.
Wonderful. So you were born and raised in Zimbabwe. What was growing up in Zimbabwe like?
Well, I was born in 1970, which kind of tells my age a little bit. But we grew up in the first 10 years of my life, Zimbabwe was in civil war. So, you know, it was a different upbringing to what a lot of people would imagine. But my parents, you know, they were farmers, they lived in remote places, and, you know, like a lot of people around the world in different farming communities, you know, as a kid growing up on a farm, your upbringing is very different to a kid growing up in the city. And so we spent a huge amount of time outdoors. I was always fascinated by the birds and other creatures and wildlife that was on the farm, and I spent a huge amount of my time really diving into what made things tick in the field. And I think that created this great foundation to what was to much later in my life become a career.
Yes, absolutely. And what a career it has been so far.
So far.
Many more wonderful adventures to go on yet. So do you recall a favorite family vacation you went on as a child with your family?
So one of the things we used to do, there was a huge man-made lake in Zimbabwe at the time, which was called Lake Kariba. It was 3,500 square miles of water surface. And probably once a year, in fact, sometimes twice, we would go and rent a houseboat and go and literally spend a week or two, you know, fishing and camping and being on the lake. There was a lot of wildlife there. It wasn't uncommon to be fishing in sight of elephants and lions on the shoreline and things like that. So it was an amazing opportunity to really have full immersion in the field. And I don't think my parents realized it, but I think that was one of the big things that influenced my foundation in conservation.
Mm. So now that you're a father, what do you think the most important lesson to teach your children is regarding wildlife?
So I think the most important thing is to make them understand the value of wildlife, but more importantly, Nikki, and something that is really difficult to grasp in today's world of very strong opinions, is what does true conservation mean? And I think that it's a concept that's being lost in the modern world. And I think that if you can teach your kids what true conservation means so they are looking at things pragmatically and practically, I think that's one of the greatest gifts you can give a child is the love of wildlife and the appreciation of conservation.
Yeah. So you have three children, Trail, Brooke, and an older child, McKenna. Now, Trail and Brooke, they have under the guidance of yourself, they've started an initiative called Kids in Conservation. And people can find that on Instagram. Now, what is that about?
So what we looked at is, how do we influence kids in the first world and make them understand and truly listen to conservation messages? And, you know, in a kid's world today, they are getting more teaching than ever before in history. If you count the hours in a school term or the hours in a month, a week or a day when they're at school, and all of that teaching is coming from adults. And so we thought, if we could deliver a good, sound conservation message through the voices of kids, that it would appeal to kids and hopefully get more kids engaged in true conservation initiatives. My kids are very, very fortunate. They get onto the front line of a lot of really deep conservation initiatives, Nikki. And, you know, it's a really cool and exciting thing seeing them truly blossom. And they absolutely love telling these conservation stories. We get them on the front line, whether they're dehorning rhinos, whether they're collaring various species, whether they're just enjoying a good, balanced ecosystem. I think that the lessons that a kid can teach a kid are so much greater than the lessons an adult can teach a kid, just because kids respond better to kids these days, you know?
Absolutely. I 100% agree. I saw the video where your son, Trail, was in the back of a transport unit with about six darted lionesses, and they were being transported. And I thought, wow, what a fearless and respectful child. And Brooke, the video you sent me of her explaining dung, that was just absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
You know, I think that, Nikki, one of the things that we try and do when we're putting these kids on the front line is make them deliver or have them deliver truly what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and fun and humorous messages as well. You know, for Brooke to be in a game reserve where there's not an animal in sight at that moment, but there's droppings on the ground from five or six different species, hopefully it gets people to realize, you know, as they see more and more of these fun little clips and pieces, it gets them to realize that, wow, this is what a healthy ecosystem looks like. It's a place where you don't necessarily see thousands of animals all at the same time, but there's lots of sign that these animals are peacefully coexisting in good balance. And so, you know, doing something like the poop video, as we call it, is a really fun way to get kids engaged. You know, seeing other kids touching poop is something that's always going to get a smile in their eyes. And so why not build that into a bit of a conservation message? You know?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So for anyone that wants to follow Ivan's children, Trail and Brooke, on their conservation, and then you can look on Instagram at Kids in Conservation. All right. So I read that you spent 30 years as a professional guide, including 12 years owning and operating a photographic safari company. You were even rated by Condé Nast as one of Africa's top 10 non-hunting guides. That is pretty impressive. So tell us a little bit about your time as a guide.
So I still do a fair amount of guiding, Nikki. And you know, one of the things, you know, the Zimbabwean guide's license is a very difficult license to acquire, as is the Zimbabwean professional hunting license. And so, you know, as you dive into that, you realize that, wow, you just by virtue of being qualified to take people on a trip and starting to explain how things work in an ecosystem and point out birds and animals and all of that, you start to get kind of sucked into this amazing, you know, environment where you seem to open one door of knowledge and behind there are 10 more that you don't know. So, you know, as you get to learn a few plants and birds and trees, you know, you start to understand how much you don't know. And then you start to realize how they all interact, and it gets to be really, really exciting. So, you know, one thing led to another, having started the business in Zimbabwe, and people would come on safari, you'd build this great relationship with them, and they'd want to come back to Africa, but they didn't necessarily want to come back to the same spot in Africa.
Yep.
So that started me doing what I call private naturalist guide trips, where I would go anywhere in Africa with these people as their host. And it gave me an opportunity, Nikki, to truly, over the last 30 years, you know, I can say that I've been in most ecosystems across Africa that have got substantial wildlife. I've been in a lot of places that don't necessarily take a lot of tourists. And you know, some of those adventures have been absolutely spectacular. And one of the things that I hold really dear to my heart is, you know, remote parts of Africa where things are still in balance, where you can feel like, you know, you're away from the hustle and bustle and the smartphones and the computers and the emails and the text messages. And, you know, you truly are just surrounded by stuff that, it, to me, really, really matters. And that is, you know, a healthy ecosystem. And, you know, I think as you mature in it, in the beginning, it's all about trying to find the lions and the elephants. Then you start to realize that the lions and the elephants can't exist without a healthy ecosystem. So you start diving into what is a healthy ecosystem? What is that? So you start understanding some of the players in an ecosystem. You start looking at the water and the insects and the birds and the soils and the all of the smaller stuff. And as you start getting deeper and deeper into it, you realize that, wow, a healthy ecosystem that's vibrant and full of life truly is something very, very precious that we need to spend our best effort preserving, you know?
Yep. Yep, I can just imagine every tourist going, what? I just want to see the lions!
You point out a grassy field, and to someone who's not been shown, they'll often say, well, there's not much out here today, is there? They say, well, hold on a minute, let's walk here for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then an hour later, you come back to the car and they go, wow, we had no idea that there's so much going on. Because yeah. There's no such thing as a static ecosystem. And I think that, you know, Africa is well renowned as, you know, when you look up Africa or you ask people what they think about Africa, Nikki, they're going to tell you about three or four things. They're either going to tell you about drought and war and kind of newsreel type stuff,
mm-hmm.
or they're going to tell you about what they've read in Nat Geo, which is the lions or the elephants in the sunset or whatever it might be. Or they're going to tell you about tribal cultures and the beauty of tribal people.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, not very many people understand what else is going on. They don't understand the fine line between the humans and the wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really understand human-wildlife conflict. They don't understand that without the birds and the bees, quite literally, you can't have the lions and the elephants. And so as you start to open those doors to people while they're on safari and fully immersed for 10 days in an African trip, you can truly see a light come on, Nikki. And that's what gets me so enthusiastic is you start to see people truly getting it and start to show an interest in the birds and start to notice the butterflies and start to notice the clarity of the water in a mountain stream or, you know, the number of primates in a particular troop of whatever you're looking at. You know, it really goes so far beyond the elephants and the lions. And yet they are such charismatic species. They get most of the focus, they get most of the attention, and very often it's to the detriment of the rest of the ecosystem that's getting overlooked, and yet they can't exist without a healthy ecosystem, you know?
Exactly. It comes back to that thing that everything has their place.
No doubt, including humans.
Yep, and one can't survive without the other.
No, exactly, Nikki, and I think that, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about a lot recently is responsible use of resources.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are talking right now because of man's ability to use resources.
Mm-hmm.
The device you're holding in your hand is made out of plastic. There's all kinds of different resources that have been utilized for the house that you're sitting in right now. And every mouthful of food you put in your mouth comes from a place that used to be a natural environment. And we need to accept that. We need to accept that man has impact. We need to accept that man modifies ecosystems. But we need to start discussing, you know, what is responsible use of a wild ecosystem? How do we use it in a way that local communities benefit, in a way that it generates enough money to support itself, but also in a way that's responsible and sustainable within that ecosystem, that it doesn't modify it to the degree that it breaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a big rabbit hole we could go down there to talk.
Absolutely.
You know,
I
like
think we will a little bit later in this chat. I think we should, and I think we will. Because,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, a lot of the time people will say to me, I don't wear leather because I don't want to hurt animals. And my reply is often, well, do you think any animals were harmed in the creating of a cotton field where they grew your shirt?
Mm, exactly.
Well, let's talk about that.
Yeah, because
I'm not anti-agriculture. I want to be really clear about that. I'm very pro-agriculture, but I'm also anti-people feeling like one person might have less impact than the other just because they've made a small difference in their life choice. Now, I think collectively things like using less plastic and all of that stuff I think is very good. There's a lot of that topic, which again, those are giant rabbit holes we can get into in a different conversation. But I definitely think understanding that as humans we have impact, and understanding that the people on the ground that are living with the wild ecosystems, their opinions, the facts that surround their lifestyle and how we preserve these wild ecosystems need to be taken into account, because very often the people that are the most vocal about our use of wildlife and use of wild ecosystems live in cities where if they look out of their window, the entire ecosystem has been destroyed to create the city in the first place, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, were you the youngest person ever to receive your professional guide's license in Zimbabwe? Is that correct?
You know, I was, Nikki, and it was quite a funny story, because I went to the, and in those days, the Department of National Parks ran all of the licenses. I went to them and I applied to write the license, and the head of exam said, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, you're too young to do so. And I said, okay, well, you know, let me just do it anyway. And, you know, let's see if you know, you think that I pass or whatever. I don't mind if you don't give me a license for a couple of years, but let me give it a crack. So they kind of agreed. It was a lot less formal in those days. It was still just as difficult, but less formal. And, you know, I, at school, I was what in today's world they would call the ADHD, which I don't like the word myself, but that's what they would have called me. And so I never focused on anything. But I can tell you, for those exams, I focused on them like you can't imagine. And I passed high enough for them to give me a license, which was a couple of years before I was supposed to get it. So that's kind of the backstory to that deal.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So what do you reckon the most important lesson you've learned in all your time as a guide up until the present day would have been?
I think the most important lesson is to think and listen to what other people want to see and how they want to see it. Because in the beginning, if you and I are very enthusiastic about watching lions, and you've got a carload of people that doesn't necessarily want to watch lions, pushing them to do so is not going to get you anywhere. But if you truly listen to the experience they want to have and have a very open mind and an understanding of the background they come from, if I've got someone in my truck from New York, I'm going to guide them with a much different stance than I'm going to guide someone who lives in the outback or lives on a ranch in Montana, just because I need to understand their background. I need to not turn my nose up at their fear of an insect, but truly see that as an opportunity to educate them and help them understand that a particular insect might not be to be feared and actually should be explored and appreciated and admired by the end of the lesson. And so I think the biggest lesson I've got is a true life lesson, and I think it goes for everything in life. If you can understand someone's perspective, your argument or your discussion, should I say, will become so much richer and will produce great fruit in both directions.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Being fortunate enough to, you know, if you come on safari with me, Nikki, if anybody comes on safari with me and they arrive there, they've chosen to spend their hard-earned money on a holiday with me guiding. There's a great responsibility there to A, meet their expectations of what they're hoping for in an experience, and B, there's an amazing teaching opportunity and a learning opportunity. And, you know, if we are to understand how the world works as a whole, having the privilege of getting somebody for 2 weeks to spend time with you, that's one of the captains of industry somewhere in the world, that's a giant, giant, giant privilege. And I think that, you know, that's the one thing that I'll never underestimate how important that is.
Yep. And on the subject of meeting expectations, Ivan, I actually recently had a conversation with someone interesting about this enough, and about the unrealistic expectations of coming on holiday in Africa, like people say social media. Social media is a great platform for many reasons, but it also can be to the detriment of a guide, because these people that some people sit home and they see these great shots of seeing lions and elephants and giraffe, and they arrive in Africa and they want to see all of them, and in a lot of places that's actually not how it is. How do you manage those expectations with the reality of coming to Africa and going on safari?
So, Nikki, I think it's the same with anything that we do. In today's world, it's social media delivering that expectation. 10 years ago, it was television and the, you know, Animal Planet and Nat Geo and Discovery, which sadly today doesn't have a lot of wildlife stuff, but that's also another rabbit hole we can dive down. But, you know, the reality of what you're going to see. So if you watch a rugby game on TV, the reality is you're going to see it 10 times better than if you pay a lot of money and travel to go and see it. Because you're going to be in the 35th row up. You're not going to see the plays in slow-mo and all of that stuff. And so I just make it very, very clear that, you know, this keeping people's expectations low and your delivery high is absolutely the way that you've got to do it. So, you know, if people are expecting a fairly rustic accommodation and they get a really, really nice place, if they're expecting to possibly see some elephants and they get to see a lot, if they are expecting, you know, just a guide and they have an incredibly knowledgeable naturalist, you know, by the time they've settled in, I think that their expectations genuinely are well over exceeded. Just because I think one of the things that those little video clips and whatever do not show you is just the beauty and the calmness of an African landscape. And you can, and what I'll quite often do is we'll just stop and people say, what have we seen? What have we seen? I said, no, we're not going to say a single word for 5 minutes. I want you to just look at stuff.
Yeah.
Just look and be here for a minute. And we'll very often get out of the car and you know, walk 100 yards from the car and lie down on the grass or whatever it might be. And it sounds kind of crazy, but it's amazing how people suddenly get into the groove and the closeness of the lion pride gets a lot less important because they start to understand and truly appreciate the whole ecosystem. And I think that all comes down to guiding, Nikki. I think that the guide that is just racing between sightings, and there are properties which you can do that, they miss a lot. They're not seeing the beauty of the small stuff. You are going to see the big stuff. Spend 10 days in Africa, you're going to see all the big stuff. You might not see a leopard, you might not see a cheetah, you're going to see elephants, you're going to see, you know, lions and all of that good stuff, lots of giraffes and herds of buffalo and all of the good stuff. But I think expectation is everything. And I think, to be honest, travel agents have also got a lot of responsibility there. And I don't think they take that responsibility seriously enough, because they know when somebody wants to go on a holiday to Africa, they know that they are probably talking to two or three different people. And so sometimes they overpromise what the reality is of what they can deliver, you know?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. For me, I just want to come back and stick my toes in the dirt.
Exactly. So that's my point. That is absolutely my point, exactly.
So Carter's War, I could not stop watching. I just wanted to, like, be right there, as I said to you in the email I sent you. I just wanted to be right there helping in the action. I just wanted to jump on the people and jump in and help. And I think it is definitely a show that every person on this planet needs to watch, and because it highlights the true reality of what is happening in Africa to its wildlife and the true grim reality. But there are also people that, despite that grim reality, are out there making a difference, are actually helping in the way that they can. Whether it's not saving an entire population, but they're doing their part to help it. And one part that struck me most was the live chimps that you discovered with your little secret camera when you spoke to someone in Congo, and the night you camped out with your tracker. What was his name?
So that was Big Livy. And so, You know, I think that, Nikki, one of the things that we tried to show through that show, and you know, camping out there with Big Livy or Livingston, he has a character and a personality that, you know, you don't really see, and you see it through that show. But one of the things we tried very, very hard with the whole series was, instead of showing just the beauty of wildlife, showing the reality of the human wildlife conflict that exists. And, you know, again, you know, the first world often feels like they don't have an impact on wildlife because they live this, in inverted commas, clean life that is not on the very front line in a third world country, you know, in poverty. But at the same time, we have to understand that the pressures of our food security from the first world are very often what dictates life in the third world. And so taking a show like Carter's War and truly looking at the thin line where humans and wildlife meet in a very real environment, whether it's cattle killing lions that are killing your livestock, you know, let's all bear in mind that the reason the people have got cattle is because the humankind as a whole, and particularly the first world humans, believe that we shouldn't be eating wildlife. And so at the end of the day, you take value away from wildlife, people are going to have cattle. And so if the lions eat your cattle, which represent your wealth, you're going to poison the lions. It's very easy to sit in your armchair in your safe first world home where you've never truly been hungry and really judge a person for poaching a rhino, poaching an animal for bushmeat, trading a baby chimpanzee, killing a giraffe for food, or indeed poisoning a pride of lions because they ate your cow. And I think what we tried to do in every series, as you saw, was to offer some of the true solutions, to highlight some of the true heroes of these solutions, but to also understand the perspective of the people that were on the front line. And I think that, you know, very often it comes back to what I was saying as one of the benefits of guiding. If you can truly get into the head of the person that you're having a discussion with, very often you can learn as much as you teach. And, you know, during a discussion, especially when it gets heated, the best discussions are the heated ones, because that means both sides are passionate. But there's no point in arguing just to be right. You've got to argue to find a solution, Nikki. And I think that a show like this really shows that. It shows the people that are on the front line truly searching for solutions rather than just saying, well, poaching is bad and being done with it. Poaching is bad, yes, but how do we stop it? And it's not just about the policing. It's about stopping it at a much higher level, you know.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And one, when you're talking about that, one episode that really stands out to me is the episode where the lions were being killed because they were eating the cows, and the cows are the food of these people in the remote village. And I remember watching it, and you got quite heated because these people were killing cows. But then once you actually went in and you actually found out and got a little bit more understanding from the people, we got more understanding as a viewer as well, as to, okay, we're not like hating these people because they're killing the lions. Now we understand why they're killing the lions, because if they don't kill one or two lions that are eating their cow or their cows, then this entire village will go without food. So then what do they do? It's a very fine line.
There's no easy solution, and there's a really sad statistic out there that I think a lot of us, it's much more comfortable to ignore it than embrace it. And that is that 96% of all mammals on Earth are humans and their livestock. 96%.
Yep.
So everything else from elephants to bats, from you know, from whatever, kangaroos to rhinos, everything else is 4% of what's left. And so when you really look at that, the human population, which is growing and growing and growing, particularly in the third world, is threatening to just simply swallow up these ecosystems and the inhabitants of those ecosystems. And we just have to be very cognizant of that and understand that, you know, again, like I said in earlier in the conversation, the house that you are sitting in right now used to be wild and natural environment. The house that I'm sitting in, the same way. So it's very important not to point fingers and to make sure that we really understand that, yes, we are talking about, you know, African wildlife and charismatic species here, but the humans that are in conflict with those species are just like you and I. And just like you and I in our vegetable garden, if we get bugs in our vegetables, we rush off and we try and kill them or spray them or whatever. That's no different, just on a different scale. And I think that that's one of the things we wanted to try and highlight, is that there are solutions, but at the end of the day, it's this fast increasing human population that is the main problem. The main problem is nothing other than that. You know, and so that's created an imbalance across the planet, and it's something we all just need to be cognizant of and aware of, you know.
Yep. So how important was producing Carter's Wall to you? What did it mean to you? Because you had Nostler's Wall backing you. So how important was it to you to produce this?
So it was incredibly important for a lot of the reasons that we've talked about, and primarily because I think it's a TV show which can and will continue to have an impact on the way people think about ecosystems, the way people think about local communities, hopefully the way people have their conversations about both. Because at the end of the day, Nikki, if you are just producing entertainment and it's entertainment without a specific purpose, then that's where it starts and it ends. Somebody sits down on the couch, they watch the show for 40 minutes, and they are well entertained, mm-hmm. and you're out the door. And we felt like this was so much more important because it had such a deep conservation message that could potentially stimulate conversations. And so, yes, it was incredibly important to us. It was as much a passion project as a profit project. In fact, more so passion than profit. And it's just something that I would love to see some of these conversations changed as a result of some of the productions that we put out there. And, you know, Nikki, I think that one of the things we can all agree on is if you can entertain somebody first and foremost and make them interested in what you're talking about, it opens the door to being able to educate them. So it has to be entertaining first. And so our partners in the project, Brandon Shockey and his team, spectacularly good editors and people that can really create entertaining TV. And so by partnering with people like that so that your entertainment was solid, it meant that more people were going to want to watch it. The more people that watch it and are entertained by it, the more people you could educate. And that to me was where my passion lay in it.
Well, absolutely. You highlighted a lot of key information that are conversations on their own to me. And I mean, it was very entertaining. It was very educational. And every 5 minutes is a new conversation starter for me. So, I mean, I have a million questions that I could sit there and watch each show with you and you'd just get absolutely annoyed with me. But you know, each you know, I'd be like, so what, you know. But very entertaining, very educational, and it has left lasting impact on my mind. So I can only imagine what it would do on a mass scale, which you've done. So props to you for doing that.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoyed the episodes.
Yes. So beside the moment with the elephant where the entire face was sliced off or hacked off, and you mentioned, I remember you mentioning the smell, and I remember that smell, and it wafted through my nostrils as soon as you said the smell. And because when I was in Kruger at one point, I came across a rhino that had been poached the night before, and the smell was, it will never leave me. So
that's crazy.
It just, even things like that, for you mentioning the smell, for those that have been to Africa, who have witnessed things, those who are doing first, you know, on the ground work, they will recall, and it's relatability as well. So yes, but there was one other moment that I'd love to talk to you about, and that was the hyena family, the ones that fed the hyenas scraps of raw meat every night. Yes, by hand. See, I mean, hyenas are my favorite African animal, with only a face a mother could love. But I had a really soul resonating moment with a hyena when I was over in Africa, and I find them incredibly fascinating. So I would love to know from you, being there, witnessing that, how powerful was that moment for you?
You know what it showed? So Ethiopia's got one of the fastest expanding populations on the planet. There's millions and millions of people there, and yet that is a tradition that is maintained and maintained strongly. And you know, I think that, Nikki, as you get into a family like that, that has spent their lives, you know, every single day going to a local butchery, getting scraps from the butchery and feeding the hyenas in a tradition that started because they thought that that would eliminate the conflict between the sheep farmers and the hyenas. It was just really an interesting little journey there. You know, Harar is also a city. The city walls were built in the 15th century. So you've got this amazing mix of history and wildlife. And, you know, I don't think that when that tradition started, anybody could have dreamed that Ethiopia would look like it looks today as far as the human element. And so I think that what's very interesting to me about something like that and being there and having these giant animals that a lot of people would be repulsed by, but also a lot of people would be fearful of, seeing all of that continue in spite of the humans and the change in landscape, it just shows how strong tradition is. And I think that that is something really, really important in our conversation about you know, the tribal participation in conservation efforts, is to understand the strength of tradition. And so even though we didn't pose it as such, that was one of my main takeaways, was that if we don't consider tradition and tribal landscape when we are considering conservation solutions, then, you know, how successful can we possibly be?
Absolutely. That definitely came through, that everyone has a part to play in conservation, not just the people on the front line. It comes down to, you know, the men and women that live in the villages, traditions, where they live, everything about the ecological environment in which they live in, and how that impacts human and animals alike.
No, exactly. Yep. Exactly. You're exactly right.
Yep. So have you always been passionate about wildlife?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Even from as far back as I can remember, it's always been fascinating to me. It's been something that's just been a part of my life as long back as I can remember, Nikki. And, you know, it just was the natural progression for it to become a career path and for one to end up. You know, right now we run a foundation that we have four different projects. And I have to say that every single day when I get to my computer, and you know, there is always an element of office work and background, and obviously the fundraising cycle is what keeps everything going. But you know, the feeling that we can have a bit of a positive impact, and even on the days where, man, it's a little bit too much travel or a little bit too much background office work or whatever, that, you know, then you'll get an email through, you know, we've just helped Giraffe Conservation Foundation to move a bunch of giraffes into an ecosystem that hasn't had giraffes for 40 years. And that is such a huge win for conservation that it overshadows any of the mundane stuff that you have to do to achieve that. So, yeah, a lifetime in conservation, and also very, very passionate currently about what we can do into the future of conservation to keep it on the up and up and keep making a difference. But most importantly, Nikki, and through people like yourselves, stimulating reasonable, sustainable conservation conversations that revolve around reality, not just emotion, you know?
Absolutely. And speaking of your giraffe relocation, about a month ago, I spoke to Dr. Evan Anton.
Oh, cool.
And he was telling me that because I asked him, you know, what's in his plans, and he said, I'm actually going to do a giraffe thing with Ivan Carden. I said, oh, fancy that. Fancy that.
It's a small world, isn't it?
It is. And he was so excited for his trip. What a wonderful opportunity for him to come along and put his skills and knowledge alongside yours, alongside the team that was doing the giraffe relocation. Just what a wonderful opportunity that was for people to see.
No, exactly. And I think that, you know, again, No, the sexy, cool stuff where you physically are moving an animal and putting it in a new ecosystem where you are, you know, physically catching a poacher, that's the sexy and cool stuff. But the reality, the important stuff is all that goes on quietly. And so using these big moments to fuel the funding and to fuel the passion for the species, for the ecosystem, that's a really good strategy, I think, Nikki, is making sure that people understand that this is the result of several years of work. It's a result, in that case, of a decade of work. It's not something that just happens overnight. And unfortunately, you know, it's true. Conservation costs a few bucks. But at the end of the day, if we can give you a spectacular return on your conservation investment, and we can show that return by expanding a species environmental footprint, I think that's a home run, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that's another thing that Carter's War highlighted, was that what actually goes involved into saving and relocating or moving or darting or getting DNA samples from a species, it's not just, let's just get in a helicopter and fly up and dart the animal. There's all the important things, like just the little facts, like you must keep an elephant's trunk straight. A giraffe, just the quickness in which you have to work with a giraffe. I felt like Carter's War also sort of touched on was that these people can't just get in a helicopter and fly up, because someone has to pay for the petrol. Someone has to get this pilot here with their helicopter if the helicopter's not on staff, you know. But they still have to pay for the petrol. They still have to pay for the people that are on the ground, the petrol for the relocation trucks. It's all that sort of thing. So,
it's an amazing amount of logistics to get it done, you know.
Combining even with yourself for something like that, what an impact you can make on your funding to further.
Well, that's the whole idea of us collaborating, is to bring his following to a place where they can truly make a difference, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so have you ever had any close encounters where you had a momentary thought that your time was up? I guarantee there's probably
many. Where do you want me to start? I think that certainly my wife would argue that is something that happens very regularly in my life.
Is that when you come home from your trips?
I think that, to be honest, one of the things is, you know, perception versus reality. So if an elephant comes running up towards you and he stops in good time and he backs up and so on, in my mind, that's completely in control. And whatever, to a viewer, they might go, wow, that was a close shave. That elephant actually charged you. And so I think that the reality and the perception is often two different things. And I think also, you know, the more you see, the less, what's the word for it? I don't know how to really put this into words, but I think, Nikki, that very often what can be deemed a very dangerous, very high stress scenario, once you've been in that situation a few times, the way that you deal with it is much more calm and relaxed. So in your mind, you don't feel threatened, even if you actually are. So, you know, there was an episode of Carter's War, I think you watched, where we were trying to illustrate how different lion personalities were in the daytime and the nighttime. And, you know, in the evening, those lions, I really thought for a minute that they might jump on us. So, you know, that sort of thing definitely happens. It happens fairly regularly, but it's also something that, Nikki, I think in the context of what I do and what we do every day as a group and as a team and with our partners on the front line, you know, yeah, we live a pretty exciting life, there's no doubt.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, these close encounters that you put yourself in a position where you could potentially be in close proximity to an animal and they give you a warning, that's a totally different thing to actually having a lion hunt you down, which is a very rare and unrealistic thing. But like, that's the difference between the perception and the reality. I personally have had encounters as well, but I was very cool, calm and collected, except for the scorpion one. And but I think it's how you handle it. And but have you ever had any unexpected animals in a tent in your vehicle?
You know, I've had a lion put his head in a tent and roar, which got everybody's undivided attention. And then, you know, one of the things you brought up earlier from you know, that everybody's got an unrealistic fear of is you often find snakes in those kind of environments, you know. You find snakes in an environment where they're just looking for their food source usually, or they're looking for some warmth. And so absolutely, snakes come in and out and so on. But, yeah, it's one of those things that you again just take it in your stride, you know. You know, we've had some really fun and interesting you know, little happenings with snakes getting into people's tents from time to time, with lions. We had some lions that killed a buffalo once in between two of the tents while we were on a safari. And you know, those are the kind of things that certainly are far away from the norm, but yeah, it's one of those things that I think that we truly we take in our stride, and it's often we underestimate what other people might think of it, you know.
Absolutely. So I read this recently in a report that by visiting Africa, you tell a government that wild places and the animals within them are worth saving, perhaps more are worth more than agriculture and mining. You create jobs, you create value within local communities for wildlife. If they learn, that if the animals are poached, no tourists come, and there goes their jobs. What is your opinion that increased tourism helps the protection of Africa's wildlife?
So I think that, again, we've got to get back to our conversation that we touched on earlier about responsible use of resources. So there's two types of tourism, and often this it starts a giant emotional reaction when I say this, but you've got tourists that come to Africa to hunt, and you've got tourists that come to Africa to look at stuff. People will very often say, well, you know, the hunters have too much impact. They shouldn't be doing it. They're shooting out, you know, the species. Nobody is measuring, or very few people are measuring, the impact of photographic tourists as well. And so when you look at the carbon footprint of a lodge that's got 60 beds, of their water usage, which in some cases is more than 1 million liters a month, of the fact that they have a giant road network, of the fact that they modify their ecosystems by putting water holes to attract the wildlife so people can see them, suddenly you look at it and you say, is that responsible and is it sustainable? Mm-hmm. Because if we're really honest, there's some of the game reserves that I know will have 30 or 40,000 tourists a year that have a really deep impact because nobody has measured these variables. And the same amount of money could be generated for that, for the landowners, for the ecosystem, for the protection of that ecosystem, with just a handful of people coming and spending a lot of money to come and hunt. And so what I don't want to dive into the pro or anti-hunting conversation, because that's for a different time, and it's not one that I'm trying to avoid. I just think we don't have all that much time today. But what I do want to say is promoting tourism has got to come with the word responsible. And so promoting responsible tourism, I agree, because the more people that travel to Africa, the more people that travel to these ecosystems and spend their money getting there, getting back, using subsidiary services, paying park fees, paying for bed nights, etc., that absolutely shows a third world government the value of their wildlife. However, when it's done to excess, as happens in a lot of parts of Africa, it is to the detriment of the ecosystem. And we get back to the charismatic few animals that everyone wants to see. An elephant can live in an environment that is partially destroyed by an overpopulation of elephant. A butterfly cannot. Mm-hmm. And so because we will put more weight on seeing elephants and lions instead of butterflies and a variety of birds, very often these ecosystems have been unwittingly modified to give tourists the best possible view of the charismatic species. Mm-hmm. And so really, when you look at it, at the big picture, if we look at, you know, a few decades down the road, it is completely non-viable. And so I like what you're saying, Nikki, a lot, but I do say that we need to caution ourselves as the human race and say, okay, is this responsible use? And so how do you identify whether something is responsible? There's three really simple criteria. Number one, does the local community have adequate beneficiation? Mm-hmm. Do they directly benefit? And is it adequate? Adequate enough for them to accept that it should be left wild and not be tempted to turn it into fields and crops to provide food for their children. Mm-hmm. So that is number one. Number two, does it provide enough money financially for the protection and the management of the area. Yep. It's got to be able to be self-sustaining if it's responsible. And so does it generate enough money that the game scouts and the game rangers that protect the animals can be looked after, the infrastructure, the roads, the water, the fencing, if there is, can be looked after. So is it financially viable? That's number two, you've got to check the box. And number three, the most important one, is it from an ecological perspective, is it sustainable? Is our modification of that ecosystem small enough that it's sustainable and the ecosystem is going to continue to thrive into the future? Or does it require that our modification of that ecosystem has to destroy a larger than okay amount of it? And a lot of these are very difficult to quantify. But again, I come back to the lodge, you know, a 30 or 40 bed lodge on the edge of Kruger will very often have a water usage of over 1 million liters a month. And then they'll have a water hole in front of the lodge that is not naturally occurring, that they pump water into every day, that attracts wildlife to come to it in an ecosystem that has not been designed to have water year-round and impact of wildlife year-round. And so really, when you look at it on the big picture, 50 years down the road, what species are getting lost? The elephants and the lions will remain, but what species of butterflies, birds, the variety of plants, what species will cease to exist there, and how will that habitat be modified by a giant photographic lodge, which is very often, in our funny human way, more acceptable than a small lodge with 10 staff or 5 staff that is designed to cater to one hunter that spends 3 weeks in an area and removes 5 animals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the conversation shouldn't be, should we send as many tourists as possible? I think the conversation should be, should we send as many tourists as possible to the sustainable, responsibly managed safari destinations? I think yes, then it's a resounding yes, of course, because if it fulfills those three criteria, the governments will make that money. They'll make their taxes, the ancillary service providers, the airport transfer people, the seats on aircraft, the light airplanes, all of that stuff gets a piece of the pie because the tourists are using that service and the ecosystem remains intact.
Actually, 100% agree with you. The part where you say what species of butterfly but the elephants will exist, what are we sacrificing to sustain the elephants and the lions? And that's exactly the point.
Alone, and again, Nikki, this is a long conversation probably for another time, but Botswana alone, they believe along the Chobe River, the elephant population there has modified the ecosystem to the degree that they've lost 80% of their biodiversity.
Wow, that's
so
incredible.
So is that acceptable?
Well, no, it's not really, is it? That's another classic example of just how much has been sacrificed for one species.
Absolutely.
So local communities are a huge part to the successful conservation. How important is it to educate local communities about the importance of wildlife?
I think it's incredibly important, Nikki, but I also think we need to also be realistic. You know, it's one of those things that, how can I explain this? You know, a community, let me go back to a quote that I once put up there. Appreciating the beauty of a wild animal is a concept that can only be understood when your belly is full. For everybody else, that animal represents food. And so the Bantu language, the root of the Bantu language, the word for meat and the word for animal is the same, nyama. It's the same word, which means that most people that are on the breadline look at an animal as food first. And so in order for them to look at an ecosystem and appreciate that ecosystem in its intact form, that ecosystem has to feed them in some way. Whether it is an ecosystem that generates money with which they buy food, whether it's an ecosystem that generates a byproduct, i.e. meat because it's hunted, that provides food, whatever the use of that ecosystem is, if it doesn't directly benefit the people, we cannot expect them just to like it for the luxury of loving wildlife, because these are people that are very often on the breadline. And so I don't mean that in an anti-tribal or a racial perspective whatsoever. It's just a reality. If you and I were living on the edge of a national park and our kids were hungry and there was a bunch of wildlife across the fence, we would very likely want to eat that wildlife.
Absolutely.
And so that is the boat that they all exist in, and we have to just, we have to make sure that, that we are being realistic in our, what's the word for it, in our portrayal of community benefits. So very often it's got to come in the form of financial means, in the form of a byproduct like meat, in the form of something that's a direct benefit, because the reality is you can build all of the schools and clinics that you like. If hungry people are expected to go to the school and appreciate that as their wildlife benefit, it's not going to work, because hunger is a basic human need that will be satisfied first before anything else. And that's just that's just a common fact, you know.
Yeah, well, it's a primal part of us, of any person, even including animals.
Really?
And I saw part of the Zambezi Delta conservation effort that they, part of their huge anti-poaching initiative is that once a week, or I think it was, can't remember exactly, they distribute free meat to the local communities. And since they've started that initiative, they've noticed that the poaching numbers have declined dramatically.
In Mark Haldane's area, we distribute nearly 60 tons of free meat every year that comes from the hunting organization, and the reality is that's shut down poaching.
Yeah, that's in the Zambezi Delta, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. In Mark Haldane's area, we distribute nearly 60 tons of free meat every year that comes from the hunting organization, and the reality is that's shut down poaching.
Yeah, that's in the Zambezi Delta, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
So African wildlife has always been the target of poachers and rich tourists seeking the thrill of big game hunting, which has increased to a dangerous rate and seen some of the most amazing wildlife in this world diminish to frightening numbers. African wildlife is the backbone of the tourism in Africa. Personally, I can honestly say I've never experienced anything so majestic, captivating and enchanting as watching Africa's beloved wildlife go about their daily life in the wild. I would like to know, what does protecting Africa's wildlife mean to you? And just on the backbone of that question, it was on a Twitter post you posted in response to, and I cannot remember just off the top of my head, the year Cecil the Lion was shot by an American hunter, but I remember reading the Twitter post in response to all the emails and outrage regarding this. So on the backbone of that, I know that you, the public announcement you made regarding Cecil's shooting was just absolutely on point. But just in your own words, what does protecting Africa's wildlife mean to you?
So I think it goes further than just protecting the wildlife. You know, we may, our kids and our kids' kids may not want to see a giraffe, but by protecting the wildlife and putting sustainable conservation practices in place where that wildlife is responsibly utilized and supported responsibly, it protects the choice of our kids. It protects the choice of our next generations of people who may want to come and enjoy that wildlife. And so to me, it's a much bigger question than just, you know, what would it be like? So let me flip the coin over. What would it be like if there wasn't any African wildlife? Would we be richer or poorer? So to someone living in the first world that's never been exposed to it, I'm not sure that their life will change a lot. But it would be really sad if they didn't have that element of choice for those who wanted to go and see it or wanted to learn or understand it or see a giraffe. And so really, when you look at it, that's a very deep question, Nikki, because, you know, you're talking to someone very passionate about wild places, someone who has spent their life in wild places. And so my perspective is going to be very different to someone who's never been to one. So again, how does someone's life change who lives in a first world city if a particular national park or a particular species goes extinct or ceases to exist? Their lives don't change.
No.
They carry on in pursuit of whatever they pursue, and we carry on down the road. However, the lives of the people on the ground that are around and in that scenario are the lives that are changed. So to me, it's a very precious resource. The biodiversity of Africa is renowned as being some of the greatest in the world. And I think it's a responsibility. It's our social responsibility as citizens of the earth to look after it, you know?
Absolutely. And someone brought up a really good point to me the other day, and they said, you ask any child what their favourite animal is, and 9 times out of 10, they are going to say something that comes from Africa.
Yes, absolutely.
I think it's more, you can't just protect one species. You have to, as you said, you have to protect an entire ecosystem. And as guardians of the earth, we have a responsibility. So
it's a deep one. We should probably do a whole talk just about that.
Absolutely. I'm keen for that one. All right. So the Ivan Carter Wildlife Conservation Alliance. Talk to me. What was the motivation behind starting that?
So from Carter's War, a lot of people said that they wanted to support us. A lot of people, started sending some financial contributions and things like that, Nikki. And one of the things we realized is that if you want to be successful, you have to focus. And for anybody who knows me, they're going to laugh out loud when I say that, because I'm pretty ADD, and so I have a hard time focusing. But the reality is, if we take $100,000 or $1 million or $10 million and we spread that thinly through lots and lots and lots of different organizations, we will help them, but we won't change the landscape they're operating. And so philosophically, we decided that we were going to select 4 of the most effective organizations that I'd come across, and we were going to give them enough support to truly change their landscape. And so that's what we've done. So Giraffe Conservation Foundation is one of them. The Luwero Primate Rehabilitation Center in Congo is another one. The Southern African Wildlife College here in South Africa is another one. And then Mark Haldane's area in the Zambezi Delta area is another. And so by giving them enough support that they can do conservation as well as they do it without having to worry about the financial aspect of it, has truly amplified their effectiveness. And so that's what we continue to do. So we use the conservation wins that they have as a currency to take to our, I don't like to call them donors, I like to call them investors, people who are taking their hard-earned money and investing them in conservation. We are giving them a great return on that investment in 2 measurable, what I call KPIs, key performance indicators. What you do in conservation has got to lead to these 2 things, otherwise you are misdirected. And I know that's a huge statement, but wait till I tell you what these 2 things are. Your efforts have to lead to more wildlife and a healthier ecosystem. If they don't, then you are not doing conservation. And unfortunately, it's as simple as that. Now, some of them are long-term investments, which will take a while. Others are quick, which can happen in a day. Translocating giraffe for a week, we transported giraffe into an ecosystem where they didn't exist. So all of a sudden, we spread the giraffe footprint by 500,000 acres in that 1 week. And that ecosystem is now healthier as a result of that. And so you could argue that at the end of a year of giraffe conservation, if that happens 3 or 4 times, and we have allowed GCF, Giraffe Conservation Foundation, to have a positive impact on millions of acres of Africa, that we are achieving a good key performance indicator. And so with the Wildlife College, they train upwards of 1,100 people every year into conservation. They're people that come from the conservation world. They are upskilled and sent back. And so again, your positive impact is on millions of acres of ecosystem. Mm-hmm. The same thing applies in Kutada 11 in Mozambique. And the same thing applies with the primate sanctuary, where in time we will release as many of our chimpanzees as we can back into an ecosystem where chimpanzees are too few, and recover that ecosystem in doing so. So more wildlife and a healthier ecosystem is absolutely the mantra. And, you know, it doesn't have to be somebody writing you a $1 million check. If you've got lots of people that want to make a difference and each one gives you, you know, $100, you can make a giant difference on the front line. So we keep our overheads very, very, very low, Nikki. And we basically empower these guys on the front line to just do great conservation. And it's that simple. There's very little more to it. It's just giving people the ability to truly thrive in conservation and not have to spend too much time and money worrying about you know, money and spinning their wheels because they don't have enough money to do what they know is really working.
Yeah, to need to do what they need to do.
Exactly.
And they all featured on Carter's War as well. Just the people working in each of those are just, there's no words. They're just so awe-inspiring and amazing and real wildlife warriors.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
Absolutely.
And so what is your favorite, do you have a favorite African animal, bird, or reptile? And if yes, why is it your favorite?
To be honest, I've always been an elephant person, Nikki. I love elephant, and I think the reason I love elephants so much is they're such an intelligent animal, but they're also an animal that when you approach them, truly interacts with you. Everything else just either runs away or comes right at you, whereas an elephant truly interacts with you. And so elephants have always been very dear to my heart. They're enormous. They're always incredibly interesting to walk up to and spend time around at close quarters. But to be honest, Nikki, rather than one animal, what makes me happier is being in a balanced ecosystem.
Yeah.
Where there's few enough elephants that they are not damaging it, but there's enough that they're keeping it balanced. Where there's the right number of predators, there's a good variety of plains game. And, you know, the birding, I always love birding. I'm really interested in butterflies as well. So, you know, across the board, when you're in an ecosystem that's truly thriving, without even realizing it, you just look around you and there's just life everywhere. And that has to be one of my favorite things to see.
I actually read this about you, and it's not really, I wouldn't say a lot of people would know this about you unless they actually know you, that you're actually quite an avid wildlife photographer.
Well, I unfortunately, the last few years, I've been kind of in front of the camera more than behind it. but yeah, I absolutely love it. I've spent a lot of time taking pictures. I have tens of thousands of images. And yeah, it's one of those things that has always been dear to my heart. I'd love to get to do more of it. And yeah, I love getting an alternative angle, and I love getting a shot that truly portrays, you know, the animal, the bird, or the species, or the scene for what it really is. Rather than just an elephant picture, I love to see an elephant picture that you can see the character of an elephant species as a whole within that picture. Does that, I don't know if that even makes sense.
Yes, it does. It does, very much so. And you even held an exhibition, in London. Was it London and Edinburgh?
No. Yes, absolutely. And so yeah, I've had a couple of exhibitions. They've gone pretty well. I think it's one of those things that, to be honest, you know, you go to an exhibition like that, you go there with a very open mind. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think that art and photography and so on is always a great gateway to also starting conversations like we're having right now, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. As the old saying goes, one picture has 1,000 words, so.
Absolutely.
Yep. So tell us about your most favourite moment or your most favourite place on all your travels in Africa.
Phew, that's a difficult one. Oh, we might have to.
You can think on it.
Come back to that one. I think that, to be honest, now that we are so deeply involved with the Ivan Carter Wildlife Conservation Alliance, which, by the way, the reason we called it that is we are aligning ourselves with both people on the front line and bringing them, you know, conservation philanthropists. So we are an alliance, not a foundation. Mm. Even though we are a foundation, I guess you understand what I mean.
Yep.
And so when I'm in an ecosystem where we are truly making a difference and making an impact and things are going in the right direction, to be honest, Nikki, that is an amazing place to be. And so, you know, whether I'm in the Zambezi Delta ecosystem, really enjoying watching the lions that we had a hand in putting there, or whether I'm in an ecosystem like Murchison Falls in Uganda, which is so prolific you can't even believe it, knowing that we have a very positive impact through Giraffe Conservation Foundation on the giraffes there, you know, when it's an ecosystem that you've got an impact on, that really makes me very happy.
Yep. So what are you currently working on?
So we are just diving into these four projects. You know, just the normal day-to-day stuff. I obviously spend a lot of time fundraising, Nikki. You know, they do take a fair amount of money to keep everybody going and keep everybody on track. Our next big giraffe thing is going to be a second move in Niger in the Southern Sahara Desert. Last year we moved 8 giraffes and and into an ecosystem that hadn't had giraffe in many, many decades. This year, we're going to bolster that population now that we've seen that it's successful. And, you know, what's exciting about that one is, you know, the West African giraffe, there are only 600 or so left in the wild. And so, you know, spreading them out so you don't have all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, is really important. So that's a big one. As far as the college, we've had very, very good success with the colleges are learning by doing institute. So we do conservation, and then by doing so, we take the lessons and we build those into lesson plans that can then be amplified across as many landscapes as possible. And so the college is experiencing a record year as far as how many people have been trained this year and the effects of those people. Then in the Zambezi Delta, we've got some great stuff happening. We reintroduced lions into that landscape last year.
Yep.
And now they've got over 30 cubs, which is great. And we're just doing a bunch of research now to see what other species may be required for reintroduction there. So next year promises to be a busy year for that as well. And so, yeah, they certainly keeping us busy, keeping us firing on all cylinders. And as you can imagine, I spend a little bit more time than I would like traveling and answering emails, but that's the nature of getting this stuff done, you know.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for the call, Nikki, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks, Ivan. So I just wanted to say one more time a massive thank you to Ivan Carter. Without people like yourself, this project could never have come about, and my love and passion for Africa could not be shared with the world on such a grand scale. For those of you who want to find out more about what Ivan is up to, of course you can follow him on social media. All the links are in the post below, comments below. Otherwise you can go to ivancarter.com or ivancarterwca.org. And on Facebook he is Ivan Carter's Africa. Ivan Carter's Africa, and on Instagram he's ivan.carter, but all the links to social media are below. Thank you for taking the time to listen today, and I hope you learnt something, enjoyed something. Ivan Carter is an amazing, amazing person who we can all take a lesson from and take a page from his book. Have a good day.